Politics Matters with Eleanor Penny, general election coverage on FUBAR Radio.
But I do think that Brexit is the biggest foreign policy blunder of the post-war period.
Well, you said can you allow me to finish? Well, do you mind?
Yeah, but I asked you a question and you're ignoring it.
No, I'm not ignoring the question. If you'd give me a minute, I'll answer it.
You come under a lot of pressure then to support Jeremy Corbyn as Prime Minister because he will be promising a so-called people's
Let me
vote,
be incredibly clear about this. Jeremy Corbyn and Boris Johnson, I do not believe are fit to be Prime Minister.
Body language throughout this evening has been so contemptuous of this House and of the people. And for the benefit of Hansard, the leader of the House has been spread across around three seats, lying out.
If you ask me why am I relatable, I don't, you know, why am I relatable? I've not the faintest idea. It seems to me the most difficult psychological question that anybody's ever asked me.
Hello, hi, and welcome to Politics Matters on FUBAR Radio, your one-stop shop for election schlock, where we sort through the fact from the fake news and where we pinch our noses and dive off the deep end into the treacherous waters of general election 2019. I'm your host, Eleanor Penny. You can tweet along and send me happy tales of the outside world beyond the studio on Eleanor K. Penny on Twitter, or you can get us on at FUBAR Radio on all good social media platforms and some terrible ones to boot. You can also email us your thoughts, politicsmatters@fubarradio.com, not .co.uk. I'm getting carried away with the nationalist sentiment that's gripping the nation. So, joining me to rifle through the headlines first is Ben Smoke, writer and editor at Huck Magazine. And then I'll be chatting through race and migration and how that's impacting the election with David Wearing, a lecturer in international relations at Royal Holloway University. And then I'll be asking Becca Hudson from the Fuck Boris campaign and young conservative Elena Bunbury if the kids are actually all right after all. And if we'll see another electoral youth quake like we did back in the golden days of 2017. But first up, hello, Ben.
Hiya. How are you?
I'm great. I'm kind of, I'm feeling incredibly energised because I've totally, like, feel like I've lost my grip on the fourth dimension. So I'm rejecting reality before it rejects me. And I feel, like, incredibly overconfident, not about a Labour victory. Not sure if the polls actually bear that out. What do you think?
I mean, it's been a time, hasn't it? We've all had a bit of one. I think in terms of polls, look, it's important to remember, and as I do with all men in my life, trust none of them. Trust absolutely none.
Trust no man.
Because, you know, we saw in 2017 this huge awakening. You mentioned it earlier in terms of the youth quake. This huge awakening of people who were energised by not only Jeremy Corbyn, but by the Labour Party manifesto and by the radical sea change that it represented from the Labour Party politics of the past and the general consensus around austerity and things like that. And none of the polls have caught up. None of the polls caught up in 2017. There was an article in The Independent the day before the general election in 2017 that said Theresa May is on course to win a Thatcher-esque landslide. Did it happen? No, she
How
cried.
How did that work out for you, Theresa May?
Not well. Someone vomited. That's what happened. Someone vomited in the Tory party
she
office.
She cried.
She did cry.
I've only just remembered that she cried.
I know, and Amber
Is it bad to not feel sorry for her?
What a day that was. And Amber Rudd cried on TV as well. It was a real time. And so I think the reality is that the polls just haven't caught up. They haven't, I think it was Kantar, which had a poll that came out last night that put Labour like 11, 12 points behind. I mean, I've just got to the point where I've just stopped looking at them, to be honest.
Yeah.
But Kantar released their weightings earlier in the election. And it said that 95% of 65 plus voters were going to vote. It's the 12th of December. It's cold. Like the idea that 95% of that group, when only 85% of them voted in June 2017, when it's actually quite warm,
yeah,
that 95% of them are going to turn up and go to the election. And, you know, granted, there's postal votes and things like that, but it's just nonsense. And I think that we need to really take these with like a pinch of salt. And they are a campaigning tool. And when there are good ones, we were talking about it earlier, when there are good ones come through, we feel energised. We're there. We're ready. We're going to do this. Corbyn by Christmas. Yeah. When there's a bad one, it's like, oh, no, 5, 20, 100 more years of Tory doom. Actually, no. It's all to play for.
We can still make Boris cry.
Absolutely.
Boris absolutely. Tears for Christmas.
100%.
The sweetest eggnog that there ever was. No, I think like that, making the mistake of using it as a kind of predictive extrapolatory tool has like been quite effective in dampening the spirits of exactly the people who shouldn't be listening to them and should be like out there campaigning. Shameless plug, like if you do want to get involved in making Boris cry, go to mycampaignmap.com to find out nearest marginals and how you can get involved like that. So this week has, I can't believe how much news has been going on this week, but like what are the stories for you that have kind of been missed from the headlines?
So I think one of the big things is, you know, we had this Tory party manifesto that came out to the bluster of Boris Johnson.
Yeah.
And, you know, bit by bit, his main key pledges were picked apart. Are there going to be 40 new hospitals? I was going to say 40,000 then. Are there going to be 40 new hospitals? No, there are going to be 6. Are there going to be 50,000 new nurses? No, like 19,000 of them are already nurses. You know, is there going to be £20 billion for potholes? Probably, yeah, but there's no money for Grenfell.
Yeah.
Like, all of these things, over and over, these have been played out, and then we've had the NHS kind of papers, if you will. And so our election has been very much focused
pulling up the receipts like for your bad boyfriend.
One time. That was so good. It was Jeremy Corbyn's account.
It was Rebecca Vardy.
But like behind the headlines, I think, if you take a deep dive into the Tory party manifesto, you see something really sinister lying there. And I wrote about quite a few of them last week, about the kind of the attack on rights. You know, I've been an activist, I've been involved in quite a few like high profile actions, and you know, felt the heavy arm of the law weighing down upon my head. But like, you know, that's the language that Boris Johnson is using in terms of, and the Conservative Party around, in terms of like human rights and our ability to be able to kind of like exercise these, and the attacks that they're going to put on is terrifying. But beyond that, I'm, you know, part Romani. I didn't grow up in a community, but it's like very important to me and important to my heritage. And there's a passage in it that I think a lot of people have missed, in that what they're going to do is they're going to criminalise trespass. So if you're not aware, trespass is not technically a criminal act currently. It's a civil act. So if you trespass on someone's land, they can sue you for it. It's only when it's aggravated trespass, which means that there's an aggravating factor. So you're getting in the way of business being done, or you're, I don't know. Like,
well, it's the law that's often used to prosecute activists, as Ben famously knows. For people who don't know, Ben was involved in the now known as Stansted 15 action, grounding a plane that was about to sort of take illegally deport people who hadn't gone through like not just illegally but also immorally deport migrants back to situations in which they face, you know, danger and death, and one of the charges was, I believe, aggravated trespass.
It was at the start, and then they decided, nah, that's not
he's
good enough.
He's
terrorism.
A terrorist. Yeah.
Let's go full terrorism.
Jesus Christ. like, you can't, like, it's just beyond belief. But yes, anyway.
I lost my thought with full terrorism. So yes, so what they're doing is they are criminalising trespass. And the reason that they're doing this is because they want to make it illegal for anybody, any traveller, to park up and stay somewhere that's not allotted traveller land. And this can be for one night. If you have the intention of staying for a night, you can have your assets seized, your home, your caravan, you can have all of your belongings seized, and you can be arrested and put in prison under new Tory plans. And these are the plans brought out by Priti Patel.
It's ghettoisation. That's
absolutely
horrifying.
And this is, you know, and I don't really like using these comparisons, and I don't use them lightly, but this is truly how it starts. This is the beginning of, you know, I was just like, you know, the basher traveller part of the election always comes quite early on, because, you know, they're easy votes to win in middle England, and, you know, nobody really, and, you know, the fact that we haven't really been talking about it, I think, is really quite symptomatic of the way in which the traveller communities, Roman communities, are seen within this country. And, you know, it's kind of one of the last vestibules of acceptable, explicit racism.
Yeah.
In a way,
is that not against rich people? Every like couple of months I see an article being like, the last acceptable prejudice is against posh people. I'm like, People are being literally ghettoised, but okay.
But the posh
okay,
people are
Jolly
suffering.
In, yeah.
They ran out of avocados at Waitrose.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that that's, you know, that's one of the things that really scares me about this election, is because we've got into this position where you've got, it's almost a circus. You know, Boris Johnson was invited weeks and weeks and weeks ago to talk about the climate in what was the first climate debate in this country. And decided not to go, so Channel 4 put, iconically, an ice sculpture in his place. And Boris, instead of, like, giving any reason as to why he was or where he what he was doing,
yeah.
he sent not
he
only
sent
his little, he sent his little blinky mate, Gove, and along with him to back him up, he sent his dad. And it's just these kind of things. And yeah, and then, obviously, the next day, we all know Stanley Johnson went on to main, like, prime-time television and questioned the intellect of the entire British people by questioning whether or not they could possibly know about Pinocchio.
It's just, it's the straws that they clutch at in order to, like, justify this, like, what they assume is a meritocracy, but was always an actual fact. Like, you know, your granddad's granddad's granddad a million times removed, like, slaughtered the right person in the Middle Ages, and therefore you, like, are set up for life, that kind of thing. It's bizarre. And the thing that kind of terrifies me most about that whole episode is not just that, like, Boris Johnson didn't turn up. Like, we kind of know that he is terrible on climate change. He's literally denied the existence of climate change before. But the fact that he would go so far as to try and punish Channel 4 and threaten to remove their licence for calling him out and not kind of doffing their cap as much as some parts of the BBC, to the frustration of, like, many journalists within the BBC, as a matter of fact. And that's true authoritarianism, because, like, that is not just, that's not something that's accidentally going to have a chilling impact on freedom of speech. It's designed to have a chilling impact on freedom of speech. And the fact that anyone would think about putting someone who is so flagrantly irresponsible with, like, the fundaments of any kind of functioning democracy is just, like, I'm baffled. I'm baffled. I'm having to encounter, like, an alien species or, like, some kind of rogue zoological curiosity. Like, I know it has, like, a lot of cultural cachet about, like, yes, we need to renew the state, and, like, people like the idea of, like, this Trumpian, Churchillian strong leader, and he's very much playing to that gallery. But it just comes across as so desperate to me, like, so pathetic.
I think the thing is, as well, is that we've seen that this is the culmination of years of these kind of politics, and we saw it in the Leave vote. I think it was ITV they threatened to review their licence over a similar election thing, the Leave campaign, when the referendum was done in 2016, and this kind of bluster, this sort of just flagrant telling of lies, and in any other time, and I was talking to a friend the other day, and it's both of our, like, first times properly covering this, isn't it, as journalists, and we were like, is it always this mad? And actually, I think we came to the conclusion, no, because we've both been involved in elections previously, and you know, whether it's in working or canvassing or whatever, and actually this feels different. This does genuinely feel scary and vicious and nasty. And I think that, you know, to take it back to the Tory Party manifesto, and it really is sort of, like, woven into the fabric of Johnson keeps calling them One Nation Conservatives, but they're not. They're absolutely not.
Yeah.
They are a new beast, a new terrifying beast of Conservatives that are just trouncing over every single part of our very fragile democracy and the very flimsy rights that we actually have and fought for hundreds of years to be able to enjoy. And it's kind of scary to see. I mean, you picked up on it just a second ago. You know, how many people are just lapping it up? I mean, Laura Koonsberg, who's the BBC's political editor, and I really don't like the general sort of bashing of particularly Laura Koonsberg, but any journalist in the mainstream. It's a hard job to do. Any foot that you put in a tiny little place, you're kind of out and you can be criticised. But you know, Wednesday last week, on the day that Jeremy Corbyn came out and said, "We've got the receipts, we have them here," Bush bashed them down on his platform. This little thing got them handed out by NHS staff, which was just beautiful.
Yeah, like actual doctors being phenomenal. Like, "I told you, we've been telling you
absolutely.
For 10 years."
Just what a flex! Yeah. What a flex!
Huge read.
But then Laura Koonsberg reporting on it said, "Well, I mean, we don't know whether the government are actually going to do it or not." How is that analysis? Sorry, how is that not just simply picking up a Tory attack line and like using it as like a shield? And you know, you then had Emily Maitlis comparing the Labour Party announcement that said they were going to plant 2 billion trees. I think you tweeted about how
crunch the numbers. It takes like 600 people.
Yeah, like
for a year. That's like
fine.
That's
chill.
Fine.
It's just trees, man. They're quite small. Like they're not. No one's planting great oaks. Yeah.
I can't remember what country it is, but they planted like 350 million.
It's Ethiopia.
It's Ethiopia. Yeah. There we go. Planted 350 million trees in one day.
Yeah.
Like, that's it. This isn't like back in the annals of history. This is like 2 months ago. This is.
And so she's then going like, "Oh, well, you know, this will be remembered as the election of numbers and lies, because Labour have said they're going to plant 2 billion trees and the Tories have said they're going to have 50,000 nurses." And it's like the false equivalence of those two figures, and it's very easy to unpick that. Very easy to unpick where the 50,000 nurses are coming from and how one would go about planting 2 billion trees. You're like, do a little bit of journalistic research.
Yeah.
Like, have a bit of rigour.
It's not research. I'm a very lazy researcher. I just literally picked up a calculator and I was like, "Oh, well, it's fine then, isn't it?" It's like very disappointing. It's such a massive anticlimax. And I think that the slippage was so quick from like, "Oh, of course the Conservatives aren't going to sell off the NHS. Like, they would never do it. It would be so unpopular to flog off and privatise something that's such a key part of the fundament of our society." And straight to like, "Oh, you know, we know that, but they, you know, would they?" And it's like, they're already doing it. They've sold off the oil, gas, airways, electric, BT, the post. Like, there's like every aspect of social wealth they've flogged off. They've already started to flog off the NHS. The amount of energy that it takes to maintain that kind of like, "Well, I guess we'll wait and see." I'm all for hope. I'm like so pro optimism of the will, pessimism of the intellect. But like, come on!
It's just blindingly. I've got to a point now where I'm just, my head is in my hands with it, because it just feels like every which way you turn. I mean, John Rentoul, who is the Independent's political editor, yesterday was saying, "Well, no, this rail fare, like they're taking the fares down by 33%. Well, that's just subsidies for rich people, because it's only rich people that use the train." Right, hold on a second. Let's just take it back, shall
Listen,
we?
John.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair play. Yeah. You've got it right. Rich people do predominantly use the trains. Do you think potentially it might be because they're quite expensive, mate? Do you think maybe if you took the prices down, people like me wouldn't have to sit on like an 11-hour coach to go and see my mum at Christmas? I could get a 5-hour train instead. Hype. Yes, we would, right? Like, obviously, and it just doesn't take 2 seconds to think that through. And people are just using this as analysis, and it's not. It's just bashing. I mean, when broadband communism happened, there were pundits galore being like, "Well, this is just a popular policy." Yes, that is the point. You've got it. Congratulations. That is how, like, politics.
People like politics. Something must be wrong here. It really speaks to the depth of political disengagement that a lot of people, I think, often rightly feel from the systems, you know, assuming that like politics is not designed to work for ordinary people. I'm like, yeah, that is absolutely right. So when I talk to people on the doorstep, one of the biggest barriers that I kind of, you have to broach is the fact that like, yeah, no, the policies all sound good and like and popular and people are behind them. But, and it's not even a sense of like whether or not this is possible. It's like, even if it is possible, how the hell can we trust politicians to do that? And those kinds of A, false equivalencies, and B, a total lack of like being honest about the, you know, possible limits of governments is, you know, it's just a condemnation of it, that people have no trust that we have an alternative to a system that puts 4 million kids in poverty, mm-hmm. and like, even people whose kids are in poverty. That is, it's just, I mean, I don't like bashing the media so much as, like, as, you know, a political analysis, because I think, like, okay, a lot of newspapers are run by billionaires. We shouldn't necessarily expect them to be, like, on board with, like, a radical redistributive project. But I have been kind of shocked at just, like, at the depth of how much I feel sold to the wolves. Because ultimately, like, yeah, this, to me, this is the climate change election. You know, we've got 10 years left to save the planet. And people, and like, people who could be holding politicians to account, and people who could be part of that change, part of giving me a livable planet in like more than 20 years and making sure my hometown isn't flooded out, are not doing their jobs properly. And like, if I'm angry, it's because it feels bloody personal, because it is bloody personal.
I think that you're picking up, you're right in the sense that it is personal, and there's almost this idea within the political class generally that that anger is unseemly, that it's not reasonable to be angry. And when you've got Jeremy Corbyn, who's generally a very, very placid man.
Bless him.
Very, like, he just wants to make jam. And, like, that's all he wants to do. Yeah. He just wants jam and peace. And when he's getting up and being fuming and angry and talking about these letters that he's being sent, I mean, you do kind of, like, you understand the reason, like, how, what this election is for so many people. And you're right, this is a climate change election, but for so many people, you're like the families that you saw last night on the Dispatches programme, or the 135,000 children that Shelter have released this morning, the figures, they didn't release children this morning, the figures that Shelter have
flooding
released.
Flooding onto the streets, chaos.
The figures that Shelter have released this morning that said 135,000 children are homeless. Yo, this is so real for them. Yeah. This is so real for all of us.
This is life and death. This is seriously life and death for people. Mm-hmm. And the idea that, like, this, the, a sense of, like, class deference would be put above that is not necessarily surprising, but God, does it make me angry.
Fuming.
We're going to have to wrap it up there. Thank you so much to Ben for coming in to chat with
me.
Hope we have you back soon. And talking of outrage and frustration, we're just going to play you a clip from the fantastic Gogglebox episode when, on NHS privatisation.
What we know of what Mr Johnson has done is a series of secret meetings with the United States in which they were proposing...
I reckon there's a little bit of truth in that, because Boris looked down as if he'd been nabbed.
Yeah.
To open up our NHS markets, as they call them, to American companies.
Oh. Is that right?
Oh.
He's bringing up the NHS because that is a massive thing that will make people not want to vote Tory.
Freedom of Information Act request was made.
Freedom of Information Act.
In order to find out what happened at these meetings. That's what happened at these meetings.
He's pulling up the paperwork.
Every single line of this document redacted out.
Oh.
Redacted?
What does that mean, Dan?
That means that if it's a confidential document, you blank things off. You don't want other people to find out about it.
A document here of US-UK negotiations.
Now, you're getting the truth.
How do you know it's the truth?
Market access for US products to our National Health Service. You're going to sell
Johnson,
our National Health Service.
No way. No way.
So he's brought this out of the hat. What will Boris say?
This is an absolute invention. It is completely untrue.
How can it be untrue? Or are we just being lied to?
So where has that paperwork come from then?
Well, what's the document about then, Boris?
FUBAR Radio presents...
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalfe's fan club.
We're joined in this year by Ingrid Oliver and we're discussing fart jokes. Our favourite fart jokes, if you've got any favourite fart jokes, by all means, write in to...
I've been a fan of.
Hashtag, I've got a fart for you.
Yeah, considering I hate them, well, I'm really talking about the low.
I really hate acknowledging...
So I saw a filmed insert with the band McFly and they're in like a limo or something chatting. And one of them farted, it just really made me laugh.
No.
I don't like a cartoon fart thing. I like a fart joke where it appears like someone shat themselves or something.
Oh, a shot.
Nick and Nat's fan club. every Friday from 12 p.m.
FUBAR Radio. Politics Matters with Eleanor Penny, general election coverage on FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome back, and I hope you enjoyed that little glimpse into how unreconstructedly frustrated a lot of people are feeling with the debate around the NHS, and justifiably so. Moving swiftly along, I am delighted to be joined in the studio here by David Waring, who is a lecturer in international relations at Royal Holloway University. How are you doing?
Not bad, are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm good. It's been a packed week in which about 4 months' worth of news has happened, but I feel like I'm riding the wave just about. So, in this election, there's been a lot of race in this race, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah.
The question of Britain's relationship to different minorities, as it is phrased, and particularly the respective parties' relationship to racisms within their own ranks and, of course, on a policy level, has been discussed endlessly and exhaustively, but very rarely well, it seems.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
And of course, this time last week, the chief rabbi came out and said that people shouldn't be voting for Labour because of its problems with anti-Semitism. Before we kick off, I do just want to put in a kind of quick explainer slash disclaimer that the chief rabbi is not, as many people who wouldn't necessarily have a reason to know otherwise, and fair enough, assume, like the Pope. He's not a kind of authoritative thought leader who decides on policy and practice and ecumenical matters for the entirety of the Jewish community. He represents about 30% of Jewish households, and the relationship of the position of the chief rabbi to the kind of British government is a long and storied history that we absolutely don't have time to go into right now, but I do encourage you to Google. Also, he is just one man with whom a lot of people, even within his own denomination, agree. And Haredi Jewish rabbis have also come out in favour of Jeremy Corbyn. Neither of them are necessarily authoritative on the matter, but I am so annoyed that someone would presume to endorse Boris Johnson on my behalf. I am pretty sick of being represented at this point. David, please shed some light on what's been going on this week.
I mean, the thing that's frustrated me throughout all this is not that, you know, Jewish people are raising their concerns about anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, and the failure of the leadership and institution of the party to deal with it. That's not just, I mean, I'm not just saying I've got a problem with it. I think it's good.
Yeah.
It has to happen because, you know, people have their dignity and their humanity, have the right to stand up for themselves, and also because as a member of a racialised minority myself, I feel like any struggle against racism that works out is good for me too, very, very secondarily. The issue I have with the way this has played out in the debate over the last few weeks and the last couple of years is the way anti-Semitism within the Labour Party is being portrayed as the unique and defining racism of British politics, and that one's entire decision about how one is going to vote, some people seem to be suggesting, should be based on that, and therefore that the anti-racist choice is either anti-Jeremy Corbyn or, more absurdly, pro-Boris Johnson. And I feel like there's no reason why we can't raise the issue of anti-Semitism in Labour without throwing other minorities under the bus and just recognising that racism in Britain involves racism against a whole swathe of different minorities and draws from a similar kind of set of histories and ideologies in terms of whiteness, in terms of chauvinism and sort of denigrating views about other racialised groups. And instead, so there's a tweet from Robert Peston, he's like RTN's political editor, isn't he, last week, and he says something to the effect of Britain has always been a bastion of tolerance and diversity or whatever.
I think it was a
like
beacon
that.
Of
a
tolerance.
A beacon of tolerance and diversity. And effectively saying, and then Jeremy Corbyn's introduced this foreign thing called racism into what was before a sort of pure and innocent British body politics.
It's like, and I'm get like, it, you're white. Like, that's, you just damn, come out and say it.
Seriously, come the fuck off it. Do you know what I mean? Like, Windrush. Did Windrush not happen?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, Islamophobia, like, the Boris Johnson has been engaging in hate speech his whole life.
Are people not currently locked up in Yarl's Woods? Are people not currently like dying on the streets because they can't get medicine because they're being denied their citizenship? It's so profoundly insulting to so many people. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that is not picked up on enough is the debate is sometimes counterposes anti-Semitism and the fight against it, against other kinds of racism and the fight against them. Yeah. But the thing that strikes me is that it's so insulting on one hand and worrying on another to pretend that anti-Semitism, which exists, yes, within the Labour Party, but also within the rest of the British state, and is very much how the ruling classes of the British state kind of understand or have historically understood their own kind of mission and reason for their existence and power. To pretend that is the fault of one 70-something year old, and if we just banish him from British politics, will be resolved is. It's so terrifying to me because I see, you know, people are being shot in their places of worship and rabbis being attacked on the street, and it so undersells the depth of the problem to focus purely on the Labour Party, and that people who literally erect statues to Nazi supporters would have hijacked the debate so much. Genuinely scares me for myself, for my family, for friends of all different minorities, for anyone who's going to suffer the sharp end of that discourse, which ultimately only empowers the far right, because that essentially paints the same picture of Britishness that the far right are trying to defend, prelapsarian perfectness that is only sullied when the left come to power.
Yeah, I mean, let's get into that, because this is really important. We tend to think sometimes of racism as a kind of individualised ignorance, like a person's a bit dumb, so they say racist things, they aren't ill-educated or whatever. And sometimes it's like they've been distracted from their true economic concerns or something like that. Like, people need to understand how racism works in this country. Like, you know, Britain had an imperial history from the 1600s right up into, like, very recently, the 1960s, within, like, you know, the yesterday in historical terms. And throughout all those centuries, racism as an ideology was absolutely central to that, you know. I know you know this.
nodding in sort of sagely thing, being like, yes, I am keeping up with this international relations professor. Do carry on.
For your listeners to kind of historicise it, the fact that racism has been right there in the centre of the British intellectual discourse and political discourse for centuries. It was one of the main justificatory kind of stories that the British told themselves about why it was a right to colonise the rest of the world, dominate the rest of the world. And the British elite would tell themselves these stories day in, day out for centuries, and that stuff hasn't gone away. So looking down on people of colour, looking down on Jewish people, that's like the air that the British political elite breathed for so long, and it's not just going to disappear when empire ends. And I think one of the interesting things with regard to Labour, I would categorise Labour as a kind of site of contestation when it comes to racism. Like, if you think about the Labour Party under Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, they were terrible on race. You know, this is the other thing that's pissed me off a little bit recently, this idea that Labour was once this great anti-racist party and then Jeremy Corbyn came along and introduced race.
Or on the other hand, the idea that anti-Semitism, of course, couldn't exist in the Labour Party because now under Jeremy Corbyn it's an anti-racist party,
right, exactly,
which I think
is
equally absurd.
Yeah. I mean, reality is it's a site of contestation, and you have racists and anti-racists, and you have anti-racists who need to learn a little bit more about anti-racism rather than just say they're anti-racists. under New Labour, Labour were terrible on race. You know, and I remember right towards the end of his tenure, Tony Blair said, if you want to get to grips with black crime, you have to understand black culture.
Jesus Christ. And, it's not subtle, is it?
And just after that, he said something like, well, I'm about to leave office, so I feel like I can speak more freely. So we're getting the real Tony Blair. Like his successor, Gordon Brown, adopted in a conference speech the British National Party's phrase, British jobs for British workers. Loads more stuff, punitive sort of measures against immigration. So Labour's a site of contestation. Like you've got people fighting out to make Labour hopefully a better place in terms of race, and people with quite bad attitudes on it. And I feel like overall that fight is going in a positive direction, with the exception of anti-Semitism, where it's been really, really poor. But Labour brought out a mini manifesto on race and faith last week, short 11-page document, really worth reading. And it's a sign of a party which at least has people in it who are really, really serious about dealing with racism. And in that document, and in the main manifesto, there's stanzas talking about we need to educate people when it comes to empire. We need to teach empire in schools. We need to teach how racism and empire have been part of our society for a long time, that they grew up together, and how if we understand that, we can unstitch these racist attitudes that result in racist policies and result in racist structures. So, you know, there's on that side, Labour at least has a good story to tell, even if it doesn't has a bad story to tell on anti-Semitism.
So what do you think that we need to kind of inject into this debate? Because it has become so degraded. Like saw a clip the other day of Matt Hancock at a hustings, who was being called out and like kind of mocked by the audience for reaching for these numbers that have been regularly debunked on the NHS, 50,000 nurses, that kind of thing. And then he knows that that's going down badly, and so he reaches for the issue of anti-Semitism, which you know, for the record, he's never really concerned himself with before. He reaches for the issue of anti-Semitism to try and kind of like bolster some support. I'm kind of pretty much using Jewish life like a human shield in a way that is deeply shallow and deeply cynical, and I think is disgusting, quite frankly. But then what is also incredibly depressing and dispiriting, the audience mocks him for that even more. And this is what cynical attitudes to the debate, siloing off different kinds of racisms from another, treating it like just a kind of personality flaw, has done, that any mention of anti-Semitism gets such bad faith from the get-go.
Yeah, exactly. That was chilling. That part of the clip where the audience start booing is like, you don't know whether they're saying you're being cynical or whether they're saying we don't care about, you know, people raising the alarm about anti-Semitism. But the cynicism of it from the Tories is incredible. I mean, you sort of alluded to it a minute ago. They unveiled a statue of an anti-Semite last week.
Like it's had a perfectly good non-Nazi who was actually the first woman elected.
Yeah. They made that. She was the first. They were erecting a statue of the first woman MP, but it was just a second woman MP and an anti-Semite. Terrific. And like, there's lots of examples of anti-Semitism in the Conservative Party. We shouldn't think about it as Labour anti-Semitism, Conservative Islamophobia. The Conservatives have a rich and varied record when it comes to anti-Semitism.
Vast depths to plumb.
I mean, let's not do them down by making out that they're just racist towards one group. They're racist to absolutely
Diversify their profile. It's very impressive. So that's probably just about all we have time for. It's such a huge topic and it feels like we've barely skimmed the surface. And hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about it more as the election moves on. But in the meanwhile, thank you so much to David. And we'll see you very soon. In the meanwhile, we have Laura McAlpine on the phone, I believe, who is the candidate for Harlow. And she is trying to overturn a pretty impressive Conservative majority. And I would love to ask you, hello, Laura.
Hi there.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing great. In fact, I was campaigning in your constituency a couple of weeks ago, and it was a pretty interesting terrain. How do you think the campaign has gone?
I think we're doing really well. We're running a really strong campaign, heavily focused on you know, issues that have affected Harlow, like the loss of youth services, play schemes, the fact that we don't have a proper bus service, the fact that you've got 30-year-olds living with their parents. I mean, really, the cuts that we faced in Harlow are just endless. And people want a local voice. So I grew up in Harlow. I went to the schools here. I'm still living here now. And I'm bringing up my 10-month-old baby here. And that seems to be going down really well. They don't want a politician that's been parachuted in, somebody that studied politics at Oxford or Cambridge. They want somebody that's a working class woman or a working class man that's actually really going to stand up for them. So, yeah, I think we're doing really well.
What is the purpose of canvassing? Like, why using this technique so heavily when other parties are kind of pivoting more to a social media campaign or a traditional media campaign? What does it do that changes the conversation when you knock on someone's door and when you have that face-to-face chat?
It's just it's difference between, personally, I'm not the best person on the telephone. I prefer to speak to someone face to face. I just get a good feel from someone when you meet them, and I've met so many people that are undecided or voting Tory. And actually, once I've spoken to them, I've said, "Look, what's really affecting you, and has your life improved in the last 9 years?" And just by having that connection, rather than it just being about social media or something they're reading or something they've watched on the television, that one to one with somebody, you just can't beat it. You really can't.
So we've been talking today a little bit about the issues of trust and the degradation of trust, yeah, if you like, in the political system and the difficulties, I guess, of broaching that, even if you have the best manifesto in the world. Have you encountered that?
Yeah, definitely. But again, I say, look at what previous Labour governments have achieved, as opposed to the Tory governments. Look at what we did after the Second World War, when we were bankrupt and we built all of those council homes for regular people, and we created the NHS. And so there is a real difference between the political parties. So we're not all the same. And for people that are saying, oh, yeah, Jeremy, he's the same as Boris, and Boris is the same as... You think, hang on a minute. No, they're not the same. You just have to look at their track record. You just got to look at how Jeremy Corbyn, what he's fought for in his life, and how he stood up, you know, to his own, you know, to his own leader previously. You know, he voted against the Iraq War. He's always stood by his principles, and so that's what I really talk about. But also, yeah, I always bring it back to locally in Harlow, and the fact that I am local, and the fact that I am just a regular person trying to make a difference in the town, and I think that usually helps.
Thank you so much for talking to us, Laura.
Okay.
And good
Thank
luck
you.
For the
Lovely
rest of the campaign.
Yeah, thanks. And send down your friends as well to help again. Because we need the help. We can do it here. So, yeah, put a shout out. Brilliant.
I absolutely will. You take care now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye. Bye.
So with me in the studio, we have a glamorous representative from Fuck Boris campaign. I'm spelt without the U, I do believe, available on all good social media platforms. Excuse me. And Eleanor Bunbury, who is a young Conservative campaigner and previously has been stumping for Jeremy Hunt in the Conservative leadership campaign. So I would like to play you a little clip that's, you know, maybe gives us a little tester of how Boris's campaign is going down on the street.
Because he lied to us, Boris.
No, because what I was trying to say...
Well, you're playing games.
What I think
you're
people want
games.
Us to do is...
You need to think about the younger generation, the people that are going to bring this country forward in the future, but you're not. Well, you're not at all.
Good luck with your professor for ideas.
People have died because of austerity, and then you've got the cheek to come here.
You're not answering.
I've given you the answer.
No, you might not have the answer at all.
No, what are you going to do about the children and everybody in Grenville Towers?
You've saved a few pennies there, Boris, haven't you?
You're taking away me pension and me rights.
Well, you get the picture. It's not. It's a bit yikes on the street, even though, you know, the Conservatives aren't doing as badly in the polls as that kind of reaction would maybe indicate. And there does seem to be a gulf in between the Conservative street campaign and its polling data, which is kind of the reverse, weirdly, of how the Labour Party are doing. And so famously, we have the question of the youth quake in 2017 and the extent to which these kind of opposing tactics can deliver or a similar kind of electoral shock. Now, Rosa, I would love you to talk about what you're trying to do with the Fuck Boris campaign, because I believe it's specifically targeting the kind of young voters who feel very dispossessed from the political system and really angry at this particular government.
Absolutely. So Fuck Boris was set up really between a group of friends who were just completely shocked and depressed at the idea that Boris Johnson could become our Prime Minister. And we actually didn't start off as a voter registration or electoral focused campaign whatsoever. We began as a street party the day that he became Prime Minister. And we held a kind of joyful street carnival in central London, eventually ended up in Downing Street, blocked Grant Sharps from going in and getting his new job from Boris in Downing Street, which was enjoyable. And then it was clear that a general election was on the cards. And I think it was just in terms of both when we organised that street carnival, which had almost 10,000 people attend, we realised that a lot of the people that were coming were young people. And what our campaign both intended to do and was then successful in doing was mobilising people who, like us, might be watching the news, be incredibly demoralised, demobilised by it, and saying, actually, you can come out with us and you can do something about it. And now that we're in a general election period, that whole strategy is kind of pivoted towards that. So it's about encouraging young people, particularly young women, who are most of our followers and who are least likely to vote, that actually they do have a stake in politics, that their voice is important in politics, and that there are accessible and social ways in which they can engage with voter registration and then actually going out and voting on December 12th.
So, Eleanor, as a Conservative supporter, how do you react to the very well-documented, at this point, phenomenon that the majority of young people under, not just under 25, but kind of under 35 as well at this stage, feel very alienated from what they think the Conservative Party stand for?
Yeah, I'd say, first of all, anything that improves voter registration, especially by young women, for young women, I applaud you for, because it's needed. Yeah, I'm a Conservative supporter, but I'm not a Boris supporter. I've made that very clear.
Interesting.
But it's difficult. And I think, obviously, the clip you've chosen, very cherry-picked, and would have, I'm sure you could get similar clips from every political leader that we have, party leader at the minute. It's difficult because I feel so impassioned about the Conservative Party and what I felt it was when I joined and how much opportunity I felt. Oh, God, I was like 16, so about 8 years ago-ish. And it's changed so much, I think, from leaders. Like, one of the main reasons I backed Jeremy Hunt so publicly was because the thought of Boris being Prime Minister scared me and still does make me feel very uneasy.
So what is it about Boris Johnson particularly? Because, okay, cards on the table. There's no love lost between me and Boris Johnson, but I think the media narratives that exceptionalise him as this kind of uniquely bad political figure kind of underplay the fact that he's just complicit in 10 years of Conservative austerity, which has, you know, killed 130,000 people. And I think, you know, ultimately that's the platform on which he should be assessed. So why Hunt and not Boris?
I think the main thing for me was that Boris's policies do align with me on the sort of economic liberal side of things, but it was a question of morality for me. It was just something that I couldn't do, because just seeing comments he's made as someone who is LGBT plus and volunteers with LGBT plus Conservatives, him calling people bum boys, him referring to burkas, people who wear burkas as letterboxes, it's just ridiculous. It's sort of like we were saying earlier, it's like the thick of it. The fact that we've got to a point where someone who in a poll people said wouldn't even trust with their daughter is being trusted with the country. But I still back Conservative policy. I was a young carer for my father, and I personally, as much as you'll roll your eyes at it, feel that the Conservatives did really help me and my father. And then I worked as a support worker, and I saw that Conservative policies were helping that. And from an economic opportunity point of view, I back that. But it leaves a bad taste in my mouth when we have people like him, when I know we have so many fantastic, caring Conservative MPs who and candidates who could have been in that position of power. It hurts me to know that we've got someone like Boris who is just pushing back our image and just undoing work that we've done to overcome that.
So, Rosa, what do you make of that? Because there is this argument saying that young people aren't, like, automatically left-wing. That's kind of a bit of a myth. They won by... Thatcher won amongst young people by a good 10-15% back in 1983. And there's a lot of arguments to say that, you know, our generation is, you know, very entrepreneurial, very kind of self-starting. And there is that conservative line of, you know, this is about opportunity, this is about economic freedom. So why do young people seem to not be getting on board with that?
So I think, well, if we're putting cards on the table, I should say that our full name is Fuck the Government and Fuck Boris. So we're not a single issue or single
fuck
man.
Fuck Boris to friends, yeah.
Exactly. It's our nickname. We understood these things as a structural problem, and I think you can understand the sort of the youth support for parties like Labour, for example, in a similar way in terms of... now the kind of difference between older voters and younger voters is kind of like a proxy for class. I mean, people of the generation that I'm in have suffered, after the financial crash in 2008, we largely live in private rented accommodation. We've had to suffer under tens of thousands of pounds worth of debt and tuition fees when we decide to go to university, which has now more barriers are being put in front of that for people like us. So I think that a lot of the, it's not this sort of cultural youth progressive quality that is just inherently going to be there, but it's actually that young people, and also what's considered young now goes up to kind of 35, 40 years old.
It's growing.
Because people are in that is the economic situation in which they're in. They're in huge amounts of debt, they're in private rented and very insecure accommodation, they're in very insecure work, they have suppressed wages. These are things which are affecting huge portions of the population and largely young people. And we see that older people, particularly boomers, have been able to benefit from more economic security than those who are young. So I think really it's a question about the conditions of young people's lives and less about the sort of cultural ideals which young people have kind of plucked out of thin air.
So when we're talking about mobilising those kinds of attitudes to the government, whether or not you see a stake for yourself in the current system as it is, a lot of people are kind of out there on the doorstep canvassing, campaigning, that kind of thing. What's that been like for young Conservatives? Because from a kind of outsider perspective, it seems like there has been less of a kind of ground game amongst like younger Conservative voters. Is that accurate?
I disagree completely. I think when we're out on the doorstep, it is when I turn up, it is normally young Conservatives who are there on the doorstep. And if you look at, for example, Andrea Leadsom's been doing an online campaign where she, every day or every other day, has been sharing videos of young Conservatives saying why they're young Conservative and why they want to go out and help. But I'll be honest, there's so many... It is still a culture of shy young Conservatives just because of the abuse that we get. Like, every single day I'm tweeting something, I'm told to kill myself, told I'm going to be raped, told what, I'm the scum of the earth, I need to go die. And how can young women especially want to get involved in politics and want to be open about their honest political opinion when that's the response they get? I have noticed a step up in hate this time than from other elections.
I mean, I think that's something, that's an experience that we share, and it's probably an experience that is more about being a woman online with political
massively,
opinions,
yeah,
rather than necessarily something that just cleaves to, you know, the particular political opinions that you happen to have.
But I feel it is definitely directed more to young Conservatives. There have been studies done on it that shows that if you are a young Conservative, you're more likely to get abuse than if you are a member of Young Labour, just because it tends to be that there are more people, it's not the norm to be a young Conservative. It's seen as still sort of the taboo thing. You're meant to be Labour, which I disagree with, but that is why it is geared more towards.
Would you say you understand why people are furious at the government? Let's not beat around the bush here.
I think, yeah, there's always going to be annoyance and there's always going to be fallout. For example, look at the referendum, the fact that as controversial as this is, Leave won and everyone still kicks off about it. But I think I get when people are annoyed with politics, but if I saw something I didn't agree with, or if I saw someone post something where I was like, that's abhorrent, that's a lie, I think I'd see it and I'd think it, but I would never go out of my way to be like, I hate you, go die.
I guess I'm not necessarily talking about particularly social media, and I'm talking about more broadly, like, what is your assessment of why young people are flocking to the left so much? Like, do you agree with what Rosa was saying?
I don't like the idea of what everyone says, where, oh, they're attracted by free stuff, because I think that's just frankly insulting to young people to think that we could be bought like that. Like, it's ridiculous. We have more intelligence than that. But I think it is because when you are younger, you are less likely to have paid tax, you are less likely to have maybe gone through job changes, to have started to have bought your own home. And that is something that I feel as disagreed with by you guys as this is, that when you are a conservative, that does lean into more of your principles as you get older and you start paying tax and you start seeing that all your money is disappearing and you're not having control over that, that everyone is choosing your services when you don't get a chance. That's why I'm in favour of, like, lower tax.
I'm paying tax and like, my money is disappearing, but, you know, a lot of that is going to sort of fossil fuel subsidies and, you know, into the pockets of landlords who rent to people on housing benefit, for instance. So we probably disagree on that matter. But what I want to talk about is the issue of climate change, because this is the big generational divide that kind of is very much has class embedded within it, because we know that the people who suffer first and worst from climate change are people, are working class people, especially working class people of colour, especially working class people of colour in the global south. But anyone who wants to have a planet around in that is livable in about 50 years' time, needs to listen to the science and say that we need drastic action now. So I sound confused because I am, right? Rosa, help me out here. Why are young people voting conservative if their record on climate change is kind of wanting? Because the 2050 target, as far as I'm concerned, is complete bunk.
Well, so I think this is another reason why you see actually large numbers of young people leaning towards the left, and the massive mobilizations of young people around, like, the climate strikes and stuff like that has been incredibly impressive to see. We had young climate strikers at our first street carnival who talked about the need for systemic change, you know, like 17-year-olds standing on the top of a bus bellowing, "We're not fucking listening to Boris Johnson," which was inspiring. I think the problem, though, is that a lot of the detail, particularly for young people who are not engaged with politics on a day-to-day basis, in terms of what different parties' climate policies are and what this actually means, is so badly communicated. I mean, at a lot of the events that we've run, I've spoken to young people and they've said, "Yeah, we hate Boris Johnson, we hate him. We don't like the government at all." And I'm like, "Cool, well, then we're doing this event and this is about voter registration." And they've gone, "Well, but why?" And I said, "Well, because there's a general election on." And they don't know, right? Because actually that news is not filtering through. And there's a huge amount of work to be done in actually being able to accessibly communicate that stuff to large swathes of people, particularly young people who are disengaged in politics, I think.
So, Elaine, Talk to me about this, because, I mean, clearly you're not, you know, I'm not trying to pigeonhole you here. Clearly you're not the kind of young conservative voter that some people might imagine. You're not, like, you know, silver spoon kind of, you know, straight white man kind of thing. Well, you know what, like, I grew up below the M25, yeah. So I can't tell, you know. I think that's an issue you've just highlighted, though.
The fact that you're saying you're not the Tory we think of. I don't meet people like the Tory that everyone thinks of, the young conservatives in their suits, yeah, gone to private school.
I mean, I do all the time, but I would...
I'm the one out there at the event, so that it's not genuinely not like that anymore.
Okay, so amongst your kind of fellow young conservatives, is climate change an issue?
I mean, of course. I think it's an issue for everyone. It's something everyone is invested in, because I don't know about you two, but I quite want to be able to live. I don't know if that's too much.
I'm pro that, yeah.
But I would quite enjoy that. But I think there are movements within. There's some guys who've set up a really good group, Young Conservatives for Climate Action, which are doing amazing work and doing amazing research on that. So there is movements within the Young Conservatives.
So do you disagree with the Conservatives on climate change?
What do you mean by about it?
As in, like, do you disagree? Do you think that what they're doing in their, what they propose to do in their manifesto, is enough?
Yeah, I do, because I think you spoke about the target and the date that's been set. But I think, what's the point of setting a target that's sooner if it's unrealistic? There's no point setting ourselves to fail. And I respect that the Conservatives are making reasonable suggestions and doing costed and sort of time sort of investigated policies that could work instead of setting ourselves up to fail from the beginning.
But surely working is saving the planet, right? As in, that's why the date matters, because doing it by a certain date means that we won't die.
Yeah, but if we physically can't do it sooner, what's the point of setting
that
target?
Well, then we're going
to
die.
That is a very optimistic note to end on.
What a great note to end on. Everyone's going to die. The world is fucked.
I'm afraid that we're going to have to wrap it up there. Thank you so much to to Rosa and Eleanor, and to everyone for listening. Tune in again next week for more Politics Matters.